This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Tomorrow, the Department of Veterans Affairs will announce new regulations that will make it easier for military veterans to claim disabilities from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. The current rules have been criticized for being unnecessarily time-consuming and even discriminatory. Yesterday, President Barack Obama spoke of the new policy in his weekly address.
I don't think our troops on the battlefield should have to keep notes just in case they need to apply for a claim. And I've met enough veterans to know that you don't have to engage in a firefight to endure the trauma of war. So we're changing the way things are done.
James Dwyer is the chief of PTSD services for the VA of Greater Los Angeles. It's the largest integrated healthcare organization in the Department of Veterans Affairs. He explained some of the changes for us.
Well, I think the most important change is that our veterans are really, they're not going to have to go through this kind of adversarial proving position. The VA grants disability, but there's quite an elaborate system and program to get through it. You have to prove that you were at the place you said you were at, and the things that happened to you really happened. For many, many veterans, that's relatively easy to do, but for many of our veterans, it's not, particularly if records are lost, if they can't remember certain things. So this is a very, very big step in really helping veterans get rightfully earned, you know, disability benefits.
And how will women veterans be affected? Because I understand women have a harder time justifying their disability claims.
I really think all veterans will get helped with this. I think that women who are on the front lines and also supportive roles, I think probably the supportive soldier experience combat stress, what we call secondary stress. And they have the same system, cluster as combat veterans. And I think their situation has been more difficult to prove.
So what does a veteran actually gain once he or she has an approved PTSD disability claim?
Well, the disabilities run all the way from 0% to 100%. And there's benefits, there's health care. For the 100% veteran, which is total and permanent disability, there's a range of benefits, all the way from school tuition to rehabilitation to it's just all kinds of things.
Right, not to mention monthly disability payments.
That's right.
Which can go up to like $3,000 a month sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah. But is there any concern at all that this might open the door to fraud for people who want to game the system for financial gain?
That's always a potential. And every large system has to deal with that. I think, though, veterans are very special. And I think anyone who puts on the uniform, signs the paper, goes over, serves, should have the benefit of the doubt.
James Dwyer is the chief of PTSD services for the Veterans Administration of Greater Los Angeles. He joined us from NPR West. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. In July of 2008, the crumbling housing market was starting to pull down the entire economy. By September of that year, millions of mortgage defaults had touched off a meltdown on Wall Street. Today, the financial markets have stabilized, but the housing market is still a mess. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax is back to discuss what happened and why. Good to see you again, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leanne.
Let's start with that first-time home buyer's tax credit. It was supposed to jumpstart the housing market, and it ended April 30th, but the impact seems to be temporary at best. What went wrong?
Well, Congress created that tax break early last year when foreclosures and short sales, they were just pounding down the housing prices. And, very few people want to buy a house when they can see that the prices are still dropping. So Congress thought it really needed to do something to step in and help. And the idea here was that if taxpayers would just help make housing a little more affordable, young families could buy houses, and that would start to put a floor under prices. So realtors predicted that once the prices started to rise on starter homes, the whole market could stabilize and heal itself from the bottom up. and it helped a bit, but it's just not clear at this point that those gains are sustainable. After that tax credit expired at the end of April, the market crashed again. We saw new home sales plunged 33% in May, and that's very discouraging. Now that companies that track real estate say the prices are starting to slide again in a lot of cities.
Well, can Congress create a new round of tax credits this fall?
In theory, you know, Congress, they can do what they want. But it really doesn't suit the mood in Congress. Right now, they're focused on reducing the budget deficit, not on reducing tax revenues. So, no, I just don't see anything on the horizon.
Are there any good indications for the housing market?
We've got one bright spot. Just this past week, we got fresh data from Freddie Mac, the mortgage giant, and it showed that interest rates are at the lowest level we've seen in a half a century. Right now, the averaged fixed rate 30-year mortgage is just a little bit over 4.5%, which, you know, that's just incredibly low. So if you've got prices really depressed and interest rates at rock bottom levels, then you'd have to think that, you know, housing is very affordable and maybe it can start to come back from there. But the big problem really is just this lack of confidence in the economy. People don't want to buy a house, and more importantly, they're fearful about their jobs. And another problem out there is bad credit. You know, in the past 2 years, lots of people put more of their spending on credit cards, and that debt is hanging over them. So lenders, even when the interest rates are low, they're just not going to loan to people with poor credit scores.
It sounds like what the housing market needs is a healthy job market.
Yes.
And people feel confident.
Yes.
But what does all of this mean for people who aren't trying to sell a house right now?
Well, it's still hurting you. When we have depressed home prices and slow sales, consumers just aren't out there. They're not buying appliances and furniture and drapes for new homes, and that hurts the retailers. And when you've got houses sitting there empty, you don't have builders creating new construction jobs, it's just a downward spiral that pushes down on the whole economy. But problems like this have a way of healing themselves. Eventually, people do get job transfers, people get married, parents find themselves with a third child they weren't expecting. Life just happens, and sooner or later, you might need a house or a bigger house. So if we've got low interest rates and low prices, eventually, there will be a new generation of home buyers who will rise up. What we're finding out right now is just that that's going to be a very slow process.
Marilyn Giewax is NPR Senior Business Editor. Marilyn, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome, Leanne.
Goal scoring is usually accomplished with skill and tenacity. But in this year's World Cup, some people, particularly goalkeepers, say there's been another factor involved. The ball. The players say the ball being used in this year's World Cup doesn't behave like a traditional soccer ball. And as NPR's Joe Palca reports, physicists say the players are right.
Before we talk about the new ball, let's talk a little about the old one. You may not realize it, but the traditional soccer ball is not really a ball at all. It's an Archimedean solid, or in this particular case,
what the mathematicians refer to as a truncated icosahedron.
That's John Eric Goff. He's a physicist at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics. The truncated icosahedron has 32 panels in pentagonal and hexagonal shapes. But there's no law that says a soccer ball must have 32 panels. Goff says for the last World Cup, Adidas introduced a ball with 14 panels. This year's ball, called the Jabulani, has even fewer.
The Jabulani ball uses 8 thermally bonded panels.
Goff says the number of panels is important.
Balls that have rougher surfaces have different flight dynamics compared to balls with smooth surfaces.
More panels, more seams, more roughness. And oddly, that means the ball goes faster.
What happens is, as the air goes around a sphere, or one of these sports balls, it forms a little layer near the surface of the sphere called the boundary layer.
And a rough surface means the boundary layer breaks down more rapidly when the ball flies through the air.
And what that means is the drag force on the ball, the air resistance, goes down slightly.
The Jabulani has fewer seams, but Adidas has added grooves that roughen its surface. In fact, the Jabulani has less drag, less air resistance, than a traditional ball. Goff says two Japanese scientists, Takeshi Asai and Kazuya Seo, used a wind tunnel to show that. Dutch player Giovanni van Bronckhorst learned that empirically in the semifinal match with Uruguay.
Now Van Bronckhorst with pace. Oh! It is an absolute firecracker from Giovanni Van Bronckhorst. 1-0 Holland.
Van Bronckhorst was about 45 yards from the goal when he struck the ball with his left foot.
It was launched at a little over 70 miles an hour coming off of his boot.
And because it was traveling so fast and the drag was less than on a traditional ball, it stayed higher in the air longer.
Now that particular kick was high up in the right corner of the goal.
Just inches out of the reach of the leaping goalkeeper. But speed isn't the only thing goalkeepers hate about the Jabulani. It knuckles funny. Okay, I'll explain. When you kick a ball, you can make it spin or not spin. If the ball doesn't spin, physicist Rabindra Mehta of NASA's Ames Research Center says it will knuckle or wobble as it flies through the air, making it hard for a goalkeeper to know where it's going.
There is an ideal speed for the maximum knuckling effect. It turns out that for a traditional ball with these 32 panels, that ideal speed was about 30 miles an hour or so.
But with the Jabulani, that ideal speed goes up to nearly 45 miles an hour, and there's still some knuckling at higher speeds, too. For goalkeepers, this is a nightmare. Marcus Hanneman was backup keeper for the U.S. team.
Well, sometimes it goes that way, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, sometimes it bends, and no one can read it.
Of course, Hanneman doesn't need to worry about that anymore. Ghana solved his problems by knocking the U.S. out of the tournament. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
It's been pretty hard to go anywhere this summer without seeing someone reading one of the books in Stieg Larsson's best-selling Millennium Trilogy. The Girl Who books, as they are sometimes called, have become a publishing legend. And their popularity is now repeating itself in movie theaters. The film version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo has made more than $100 million worldwide. This weekend, the second film in the trilogy opened. It's called The Girl Who Played with Fire. Bob Mondello has a review.
We pick up computer hacker Lisbeth Salander a year after we left her in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo on a Caribbean island enjoying the fortune she'd absconded with. She's about to confirm a tattoo removal appointment when she's interrupted by her real estate broker.
All right, Miss Salander. I've bought the apartment in Stockholm, the one on Fiskargatan. I've also arranged a post office box in Stockholm in the name of Wasp Enterprises.
That post office box will cause problems later, but for the moment, all's clear as she leaves the Western Hemisphere and the English language behind to head for Sweden, where her partner from the first film is investigating a sadistic prostitution ring patronized by government bigwigs. Shortly after her arrival, a savage series of homicides all but stops that investigation, with all clues pointing to her as the assassin. In the first film, her partner couldn't escape his face on newsstand headlines. In this film, it's Lisbeth's turn as she tries to find and deal with whoever set her up.
Flytta på dig, jävla miffo.
Noomi Rapace, who plays Lisbeth, seemed a supporting character last time, assisting a reporter as he investigated a family conspiracy with a connection to World War II. In Girl Who Played with Fire, Lisbeth takes the lead, uncovering a different family conspiracy, this time involving the Cold War. Where the earlier film was a mystery, this one's a police procedural, or rather a police-free procedural, since the authorities are almost entirely useless in novelist Stieg Larsson's Sweden. You knew from the first film that Lisbeth played with fire. Here you find out why, though for the longest time it's a hulking blonde guy you wish could be kept away from matches. Like most second parts of trilogies, this one is more or less all middle. It ends a bit inconclusively, and it's not as gorgeously filmed as Tattoo, possibly because it and the third segment were handed off to a new director and screenwriters to be done on Swedish TV. That's resulted in a certain reduced intensity, but the first picture's ferocity remains intact here, as do its fetishes regarding political corruption, sexual violence, and the riveting Noomi Rapace, whose leather-clad, bisexual feminist is as compelling as ever, a battered but unbowed avenger for the arthouse crowd, playing with fire, both literally and metaphorically. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Sloane Crosley is a book publicist who hit pay dirt with her own writing, a best-selling collection of New York-centric humorous essays called I Was Told There'd Be Cake. For her second collection, just out, How Did You Get This Number?, she ventures from Manhattan to Portugal and beyond.
I had always, when I was younger, wanted to spin a globe and point to somewhere and go to the place to which I pointed. And that is exactly what happened. Actually, that's not exactly what happened. The first time I did it, I pointed to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And I thought, well, no one's here to see me cheat. I don't need to be on a raft right now. So I did it again, and that's when I hit Lisbon.
You are a New York City woman, and there's an essay in the book when you were your best friend in your best friend's bridal party in Alaska.
Here are the types of Alaskan residents, not including native tribes. 1. Military personnel. 2. State builders. 3. Nature enthusiasts. By which I mean raw, in-your-face nature. Birdwatching is for house cats. 4. Hippie nutballs who looked at Portland, Oregon and thought, this is way too urban, I have to get out of here. 5. People who have at one point done something very illegal involving a sawed-off shotgun and freezer bags.
This is, to just put it in a category, kind of a fish-out-of-water essay. The city slicker goes to the country kind of thing. Right. When you were writing it for the collection, was it a challenge to keep it from becoming a cliche?
Yes. The challenge is, in the effort to avoid cliché, you might go too far. I think in the effort to avoid cliché, sometimes you think, well, the easiest way to do that is to add an additional spark, an additional story, something that's totally unique. And what you risk in doing that is doing this sort of dancing monkey routine and having a joke per minute, per hour, per sentence. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, while you're not looking, it turns out that your essay has lost its meaning. Huh. And it's lost its sort of universal application. So it's sort of a tightrope to walk.
Paris. Now, this was when you were 19, right?
Yeah, the first time I went there, I was 19.
Okay. Tell us what happened at Notre Dame.
I had gone to Paris, and I had gone with a friend, and we decided to do a day of visiting cathedrals, and there were some museums in there as well, I believe. But the highlight for her especially was Notre Dame. And we went, and I was waiting in line with her for confession, and I had always thought that confession was like the movies. I didn't have a lot of direct experience with it because I'm Jewish. And I thought that, you know, you go and you go into a sort of small little velvet phone booth and you give up everything you have and you're hopefully absolved. And then that's that. Where do I start? Emily was giddy with intimidation. I hadn't thought of this. If you are 19 years old and have never confessed, do you begin with the cigarette inhaled before noon this morning, or the time you stole a package of sparkly pipe cleaners from your second grade art class and kept them in the bottom of your closet for 2 years, eventually throwing them out because you felt so guilty? Do you mention the lying, the drinking, the cheating, the gambling, the masturbation, the Schadenfreude, the disrespecting of your parents, the disrespecting of other people's parents, the doing of the drugs, the shoplifting of the gum, the coveting of worldly goods, the advantage taking, the responsibility foisting, the tone you use with food delivery people when you're alone and they're foreign, that time you had a hangnail on your toe, so you stuck your foot in your mouth and you bit it off like a monkey? Or is that all kind of a given by now?
At Notre Dame.
And at Notre Dame, really. I just chose the most, Olympic grandest stage I could find.
Why do you think the essay form suits you? I ask this because the last piece in the book is almost novella-sized, and are you beginning to write longer pieces?
It's huge, that last piece. I didn't think I actually had anything to say. And then out popped this, 13,000-word baby. I have always wanted to write fiction, and I do think that the essay format suits me for now because a little bit of your work is done for you. That's the dirty secret with nonfiction. You have sort of 15% of the world to work off, and then you do the rest. You don't have to create everything from whole cloth. And I think, life in New York especially is so frenetic that the idea that you can stop, that you can write an essay and move on to a different thought and take that thought to its completion without actually having to constantly check back in with it is kind of a relief. And it's easier to be funny, I think, in a shorter format.
Sloane Crosley's collection of essays is called How Did You Get This Number? And the author joined us from our New York studio. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Atticus Finch, the hero of To Kill a Mockingbird and its most famous character, has inspired many fans of the novel, including Weekend Edition essayist Diane Roberts.
My heroes have always been lawyers. John Adams, who defended the Boston Massacre Redcoats. Sarah Weddington, who argued the Jane Roe case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall, of Brown versus the Board of Education fame. And Atticus Finch, of course. He's one of the most important lawyers of the last 50 years, even if he is only a character in a novel. Now, Harper Lee didn't invent the type. Earl Stanley Gardner's Perry Mason was wowing juries with his razor-like brain about 30 years before To Kill a Mockingbird was published. William Faulkner's Gavin Stevens, the premier legal theorist of Yoknapatawpha County, Mississippi, also predates Atticus. But Scout Finch's daddy is an aristocrat, a great orator, a barrister saint. The Alabama State Bar even erected a monument to him in Monroeville, Harper Lee's hometown. Gregory Peck, linen-suited, super-handsome, uber-charming Gregory Peck, played him in the movie. No lawyer ever had better. It doesn't matter that he's not a real person. Atticus Finch influenced the intrepid, if more flawed, protagonists in the novels of John Grisham and Scott Turow. Generations of lawyers cite him as their reason for taking up the profession. Civil rights lawyer Morris Dee said he was inspired by Atticus Finch's brave defense of Tom Robinson, the black man falsely accused of raping a white woman. And I suspect Atticus Finch taught that eloquent Harvard-trained lawyer currently occupying the Oval Office something about empathy. Like when he says, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." Much as I admire Atticus Finch, however, there are limits to his virtue. He's a good progressive on race, but when it comes to the pitiful Mayella Ewing, Tom Robinson's alleged victim, he treats her like poor white trash, the lowest of the low. And remember, Atticus loses Tom's case. Hardly surprising, I guess, with an all-white jury in the Jim Crow South. Noblesse oblige has been served, but Tom is shot and killed, and it's hard to tell if anything in Macomb, Alabama, has really changed. But Atticus is still my hero, if only because he does that hardest thing, defying his society, risking his reputation, all in the name of justice.
Diane Roberts teaches English at Florida State University in Tallahassee. This is NPR News.